KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Alan First writes spy novels that anyone with a passion for World War II history should love. As Los Angeles Times critic Scott Timberg puts it, he owns the pre-World War II period as completely as John le Carré owns the Cold War. First has published 10 novels, all set in Europe in the dark and difficult days of the late 1930s and early 1940s. The latest is called The Spies of Warsaw, a conversation with novelist Alan First, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Alan First always writes about the same times, the period just before World War II as Europe inched towards war. His characters, notes a recent review in The Guardian, reflect the narrative curve of history, the biographical curves of real lives. His latest novel is called The Spies of Warsaw. It's the saga of Jean-François Mercier, a French military attaché stationed in Warsaw in 1937. Mercier knows war is coming, that Germany will likely soon invade France. But how? France has constructed the seemingly impregnable Maginot Line, but Mercier hears rumblings of an alternative approach. Where else, wonders Mercier? The forests between Germany and France, under the artillery of the Maginot Line forts, suicide. That left what? That left the Ardennes in Belgium, north of the Maginot Line. No, for a thousand reasons, a very remote possibility. But he thought, somewhere. The novel tracks Mercier's relentless quest to figure out what Germany is planning to do, and the even more difficult task of convincing his French superiors of the validity of that information once he has it. Alan First's fiction is not only set in a specific time, it's rich in detail, in the kind of observational specificity that places you in a particular place and time, a time filled with tension and a kind of longing. Alan First joins us now. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on our program. Let's begin with this time in the late 1930s in Warsaw and what you do to begin to tell a story, because I read once where you said that you can't create a plot on your own, that you have to go back to a very specific moment in
right.
time.
Right. I can't create a plot on my own. It, as I've said, it comes out reading like a plot, a plot in a novel, which is not the best thing to have. So what I determined to do was take my narrative line from history, which writes better than, unfortunately, more surprisingly, than any novelist could. And so the way I work is in specific countries, when I decide on a country, I learn the national politics, the national political history, and therein somewhere in those years, 34 to 41, lies the spy story, the real one.
And where did this specific story come from, the quest of this French military attaché, Jean-François Mercier, to try to figure out what the Germans were up to? Is that based on a specific incident that you were aware of?
Yes. France was shocked to lose a war in 50 days with a 5-million-man army attacked by 500,000 German soldiers. This really made Europe and the world tremble. Not so much the previous year's victory of the Wehrmacht in Poland. That was expected and by sophisticated people. They thought the Poles would last longer and they didn't know about the Blitzkrieg, except that they did know about the Blitzkrieg, except that the French military attachés, in truth, in the late 1930s, had a pretty good idea of what the Germans were going to do. They simply couldn't get the political people in France or the high military people to accept it.
So let's step back and set the scene for what was the reality in the 1930s. France had constructed the Maginot Line, and there was the belief, well, tell us first what that actually was and why at least some people in France thought that would be sufficient.
The idea was defense. the idea was that the First World War, a horror in which France experienced 57 mutinies and 111 divisions. It was much worse than anybody really understood at the time because they kept it a secret. But the French soldiers simply tired of being slaughtered. It was a question of, you know, at a certain hour, gentlemen, you climb out of the trench and walk forward into machine gun fire, which dutifully mowed them down. Then the Germans did the same thing. Then they went out and got the wounded and the dead, and then they did it again. This couldn't go on. The people couldn't stand it anymore. The First World War actually ended with German mutinies. People don't seem to know that. They think, well, let's sign an armistice, but that's not what happened. In any event, the idea of the French was to then construct this Maginot Line. It was very complicated. It had elevators. It was built on several levels. It had Jean-Paul Sartre operating weather balloons. There was absolutely nothing they didn't have. And however, it ended. Do you know what I mean? It's like a wall, and there's a certain point where the wall ends, and the natural instinct of a human being is to go to the end of the wall, look around, and say, well, what if I just walked north and went around it?
And that's the Ardennes.
That's exactly what it is. That's the Ardennes. And the intelligent military attachés in France knew that's where the Germans were coming. There's basically no other good place to attack France, which is what it says in the first part of the book, which de Gaulle said in 1934. What attracted me to all of this is the fact that all these people wrote books. And in the books, they all said what would happen. And then it happened. And the French lost their country.
And what was going on, do you think, that the higher-ups in the French military refused to see?
What was going on? Stupidity. When de Gaulle wrote his book, and he said, in 34, okay, 6 years early, he said, we need shock brigades of tanks, because that's the way the next war is going to be fought. About 2 years later, Guderian, the German general who led the attack, he wrote a book, and he said, the way to fight the next war is with tank brigades. Then the Germans, and it's all in this book, the Germans said the same thing in their technical journals that the army produced. Pétain, who was the head of the army...
In France,
dismissed this idea. And he said, if the Germans come through the Ardennes forest, we will be waiting for them with barbed wire and machine guns. He would be waiting for them with World War I. And it was much too late for that. And so what exactly happened, when what the French came later to call the debacle, was that the German armies came right through the Ardennes forest. And the tanks came through the Ardennes forest. And how did they know they could get through the Ardennes forest? German intelligence officers wired tank-width pieces of pipe to the fronts of their cars and drove into the forest.
Which you describe in the novel. So that particular scene, which is a great scene in the novel, where Mercier sneaks out into the forest to observe a tank maneuver that the Germans are conducting on the German side of the Polish border, and he sees that they're driving a car with a piece of pipe, and he understands that might be what they're up to. So that was known. This is all information
this
that was out
there. All known. I call this my 9-10 book.
As opposed to a 9-11 book.
Yeah, this is the book about 9-10. This is a book about people who know what's coming and cannot persuade their superiors or the politicians that it's going to happen.
And where did the character of Jean-François Mercier come from? How do you find this sort of interesting character, a man who's middle-aged, has gone through World War I, is injured, but has this desire, this longing, this pursuit of trying to protect his country? Is that based on a particular figure? Is that based in your imagination? Where does Jean-François Mercier come from?
Well, he comes from two sources. The first was kind of just a serendipitous event. I lived in France about 10 years, and I was living in Paris in the late 80s and was driving on a small road down through the forest of Fontainebleau, not wanting to take the A6 down to Lyon. And I'm driving along through the forest. And here come four horsemen. And as they approach, coming down a bridle path through the forest, they're wearing French military uniforms, jodhpurs, high boots. And I look at them and I go, oh, my God, that's French cavalry. Whoever saw that in the 1980s? And I never forgot it. And I never forgot these guys' faces, because they did not look like the normal market Frenchmen from Paris. They looked a little bit different. And when I decided to write this book, and I decided that the reader should see these events through was a French military attaché, logically that was an aristocrat. Logically it was a decorated military hero, aristocrat, who would be the sort of person who could get the assignment as the military attaché at the French embassy in Poland, in Warsaw. He's a logical character.
Alan First, our guest this hour, his new novel is called The Spies of Warsaw. Describe the times. There's a sense of apprehension, a sense of shadows falling. What was it like in that time, in Warsaw, across Eastern Europe, Western Europe as well, on the eve of what everyone seems to know was coming?
A mixture of unbearable tension, in that what was about to happen was something that was about to happen again.
Yeah,
it had happened 20 years earlier, and now it was going to happen again. And people were maddened at the idea. There wasn't a town in France where you didn't see women in black, widows from World War I, on the eve of 1939, when the war started. They had never recovered. So there was that. But there was also a powerful kind of live for today, for tomorrow we die. In fact, tomorrow there was a pretty good chance they would die. And this tended to work its way also into the erotic life of the country, because a man and a woman meeting in the winter of 1940 might well think, we don't have much time.
Yeah.
It's not like we can get married and wait till next year, this and that. And the other thing, if we want to make love, we'd best do it now. So there was also this kind of wild, passionate romantic strain that runs right through the 30s
and runs right through this novel as well. There's a sentence that Janet Maslin in her review in the New York Times comments on. I'll read the sentence. This is when Mercier and his lover are aboard a train, and the sentence goes like this. They paused, shared a look of exquisite complicity, and she raised her hips. And then Janet Maslin goes on to say, this is one of those Alan First one-sentence erotic marvels that could truly stop a train in its tracks.
She's very kind.
Are those scenes hard to write? I mean, where do they come from?
They are impossibly difficult. If you really want to give somebody a hard time, assign them to write an erotic novel. It's very hard to do, because the first couple times through, it comes out vulgar. And I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is, first of all, I have rather sophisticated readers. I know this. I mean, I tour, I see who they are, et cetera, and so forth. And what I'm doing is writing about the sex lives of my readers. I am not writing about the sex lives that characters experience in books. Nobody in my books lifts a woman up against a wall because they feel so passionate that they want their knees to tremble. My people make love like adults. They make love like the readers make love. I don't see any reason to be any different about it. Not that that isn't passionate. Not that that isn't can be extremely erotic and lots of fun. So basically, that's hard to do, because it's hard to purge yourself of all the kinds of cliches about this subject that work themselves into novels. And essentially, the cliches are there to make it easy for the novelist, I have to say.
You were saying before about on the eve of war, there is this sense of dread and this sense of desire and longing. And we just talked about the longing and the desire. I guess I want to also come back to the sense of dread and the sense that on both sides, there are at least some people who are in their armed forces, who are working in intelligence, and who really want to avoid this. You have Jean-Francois Mercier on the French side, and then you have this interesting character of Dr. Lapp on the German side, who also wants to see his way around this. There's this sort of, and there's this kind of gentlemanly dance they do between each other, because they both want to not see the world come apart again.
There were two intelligence services operating in Germany at the time. They're both in this book. One of them was called the SD, led by a lawyer from Berlin. And it was the SS counterintelligence. The SS were the people with lightning flashes on their shoulders. They were the ones who murdered Jews, etc., and so forth. The other intelligence service in Germany was called the Abwehr, and it was the military intelligence service. And it was sophisticated, aristocratic, noble, hated Hitler, plotted against Hitler for the whole war. The director of that service was ultimately executed for his part in a plot against Hitler. And for the many reasons Germany lost the war, one of them is that their own military intelligence service worked against them. So that particular spy's truth is also part of this spy fiction.
And was there a kind of honor among thieves, for lack of a better description, mentality? Is that also based on a historical reality that there are these people who are engaged in clandestine work but had a certain sort of code of honor, believed in certain principles? Where does that also come from?
I think that's probably also true in the period now, okay? I think this is also true in the 30s. But it's not true between all the services. At your peril, you would assume that the Soviet Union's intelligence service was going to operate that way because they were just brutal. However, it was also true in the same way that it was in Germany that the NKVD, the political police, those were the people who came at midnight and murdered you and threw you in a ditch or took you away and tortured you in the Lubyanka. On the other hand, the GRU, military intelligence, those were the people that employed intellectuals to spy who were actually quite productive, who actually found out a lot of things, who ran the so-called Red Orchestra networks in Belgium. Very, very different.
Was it difficult for you as a Jewish American writer to find that, to discover that humanity, to write about that part of Germany in the run-up to World War II?
No, I think what I had to do as a Jewish American writer was simply come to terms with how much that was going to play a part in my novels, and frankly, how much it was not. Mm. I am not a Holocaust writer. Mm. I am very careful and controlled as to how much of that kind of thing goes on in these books. Yeah. That's not what I'm about. That's not what I'm doing in my personal life. I would certainly sign a petition and march and do anything I felt I needed to do, but I'm not an anti-Holocaust novelist.
Alan First, his new novel again, The Spies of Warsaw. What do you make of our continuing fascination, I guess, with this period of time?
The good war. The good war fought night after night on history television, and we win every night. It's really amazing to me. And I've asked myself, it's not only these books. Look at the incredible number of books, plus everything on television again and again and again and again.
The Ken Burns series last fall.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's as though we're saying to ourselves, we did fight a good war. We did do honorable things. And it's as though we're trying to tell ourselves to do it again in some funny kind of way. Well, I don't know what are the reason it would be for. Or either that, or it is so dramatically entertaining that there's simply nothing that would take its place. Well, I guess that's a possibility.
And is that appeal beyond generations? I mean, is it not only something that's people find fascinating who were a part of that so-called greatest generation, and their sons and daughters who saw it through their eyes? Does it extend to people in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s? Is it something that people find compelling beyond generation?
It does seem to be so. I would say that the greater portion of people interested in it are probably in their 50s. And then I think it gradually decreases as you get lower and the war gets farther away from you and other wars intervene. For somebody who's now 21, they're thinking about Iraq. And if they go back to the past, I suppose they think about Korea and Vietnam. On the other hand, in terms of video games, in terms of what's on television, they continue to be very conscious of World War II and that it was a large, important thing. I think for some of them, it's probably the limit of their historical knowledge. Do you know what I'm saying? In other words, the limit in terms of going backwards.
Are there lessons to be learned? Are there parallels? Do you see things that we can glean from that period of time that apply to where we are in America in the year 2008?
The lessons, I think, that come out of World War II is if when you get somebody like Hitler, and he simply stands up and says, here's what I'm going to do, it's probably not a bad idea to believe him and to take measures to stop it early. You might save 20 million lives that way. And the worst thing you can do is let it grow. For whatever reason, if you look around today at various countries which are police states, all over the place, on every continent, Burma, Zimbabwe, all over the place, now Russia again, what this is, I call this a virus. It seems to be a human virus, a kind of fascist virus that appears in a certain nation. It grows, it takes hold, it isn't killed early, and by the time it reaches full blossom, it's murdering people right and left, it's putting journalists in jail, it's throwing diplomats out of the country, it's doing everything that these countries do. And it never stops. It was that way in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, it's that way again in 2008.
To take a break in a moment, but is that also why you write about the period of time, excuse me, leading up to that moment, that you want us to focus on that time when we're inching towards disaster as opposed to writing about disaster?
Yes, absolutely. I am an anti-fascist novelist. I mean, it's not like I have a political agenda, but if I had to use an expression about myself, that's what I would say. And the interesting time was during its tender growth, because you can watch it grow tendrils and sprout and, you know, sort of like a horror movie where the monster grows and grows and grows until it starts killing people in the city. It's the same thing that went on in the 1930s, one country at a time, one politician at a time, propaganda. You know, it grew slowly. It didn't happen right away.
So will you stay in that channel, the sort of 1934 to 1941 zone?
Absolutely. There's no question.
There's more to be done?
There's every time I write a book, two new ones are written. Two new histories come out.
Yeah.
The thing about it that amazes me is the number of stories that are generated by that period. World War II was a worldwide war. It involved millions and millions of people and thereby generated hundreds and hundreds of stories. And every time I start research for one book, one story, I'll find another one waiting for me up ahead. If that stops someday, then I'll stop too.
Alan First, our guest this hour, his new novel again is called The Spies of Warsaw. We welcome your calls and emails to our program this hour, too. If you have questions for Alan First, thoughts about that period of time, what fascinates you about it, what perhaps we can learn from it in America in 2008, you can call us now. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Back with more with Alan First in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, the novelist Alan First. His new book is called The Spies of Warsaw. Why don't you read something from us, for us, if you would, Alan, from the book about that particular time and the effort that was going on to try to figure out what the Germans were up to.
This is a passage from approximately the middle of the book, which is about spying on German tank maneuvers in the Black Forest. And, of course, the Deuxième Bureau in Paris has set several spies to do this. They don't have the one guy on the hillside, although Mercier is, in fact, within binocular range of the tank exercises. They've sent also a man traveling as a traveling salesman, and they've sent an older couple known as the anniversary couple. In the town of Schramberg, the anniversary couple was enjoying the fourth day of their vacation. On the morning of the 14th, after a copious breakfast, as the lady who'd rented them a room waved from the doorway, they set off for their daily walk in the Black Forest. Such a sweet couple, in their loden green walking shorts, high stockings, and alpine hats. They headed south out of town, as their kind hostess had recommended, but then turned north, using a compass to make sure they weren't going around in circles. After an hour's walk, they took a radio receiver from a knapsack and ran its aerial up a tree, fixing it in place with a piece of string. No result, so they kept walking. On the fourth attempt, it worked. Holding a pair of headphones to his ear, the elderly gentleman smiled with satisfaction. A babble of voices, commands, curses, yes-sirs and no-sirs, the radio traffic of a tank formation moving over difficult terrain. The anniversary couple were now within range of shortwave tank radios about 5 miles. They connected a wire recorder to the receiver and settled in for the day. Likely the people they worked with would make sense of it. Certainly the couple hoped they would. Not worked for, the way they thought about it, but worked with. They had refused payment. Their spying was an act of conscience. Sincere Christians, German Lutherans, they had watched with horror as the Nazis violated every precept sacred to them. But then, what to do about it? They could not leave Germany for a list of commonplace domestic reasons, so they had traveled up to Paris a year earlier, taken a room at an inexpensive hotel, written a note to the General Staff headquarters, and settled in to wait. It took a week. Then two men appeared at the hotel, and the couple offered their services. No, they didn't care to be paid. They had prayed together for hours, they explained, down on their knees, trying to make this decision, but now it was made. The people who led Germany were evil, and they were obliged by their faith to act against them. Very well, said one of the men. Give us your address in Germany, we'll see about who you are, and then, in time, someone will get in touch with you. 3 months later, someone did.
A reading from Alan First's novel, The Spies of Warsaw. Part of what I really enjoyed about the book was were those small characters. They appear at just that one time, and there's such detail right down to what they're wearing and how they got the information. Where did they come from? Were there couples like the
anniversary
couple?
Absolutely. What I said in the original promotional material for the book was that there were 22 spies in The Spies of Warsaw, or maybe 23. Or could it be 24?
Uh-huh.
Because some of them you never find out about. You think they might be spies, but it's not determined within the book. They come from the intelligence histories, real simple. And yes, that's exactly how it was done and actually the kind of people who did it.
And to our callers this morning, we're joined first by Jazz in Redwood City. Jazz, go ahead.
Hello. I am currently reading City of Thieves, and Spies of Warsaw is next up in my queue. And I recently heard a vet call or say that Vonnegut called World War II the last war that the U.S. won and that they deserved, that we deserved to. I was wondering what you think fiction can say about the war that all of these numerous histories cannot.
We're having a problem in our studio with our speakers, so we weren't able to hear all of your question, but I think I got part of it, and I'll relay the question to you, Alan. Jazz was asking about what fiction can add to our understanding of World War II that official history cannot. What can fiction give us that reading the nonfiction version doesn't?
Basically, what fiction gives you is the psychological, spiritual dimension of human feeling. That's the job of fiction, whereas the job of history is to report the events and the reaction to events by people in a given country. What the fiction writers do, what they did at the time, and what I'm trying to do now looking backwards, is essentially write about how people felt and how they tried to deal with terrible situations going on around them.
Jazz, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Michael in San Francisco. Michael, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I would like to make a couple comments. First of all, I don't think enough can be written about World War II. and all the events that led up to it. And I know it's a common belief that the winners write the history, and I'm certain that we're so fascinated with it because we won, but then, of course, losers don't get to write any history, except maybe much later. But I think our real fascination with it is because it is such an important event in the it is the most important event in the 20th century, and it has changed our whole history going forward right up until today. So events that happened today are because of what happened 60 years ago, because in a very short period of time, less than 20 years, you had two huge wars that involved virtually the whole world and displaced millions of people and resulted in millions more being died. And there are people alive today, of course, that are sons or daughters of some of those who died.
Michael, thank you. Yeah, yes. Thanks for the call and the observation.
All right.
Curious about Michael's point, Alan, first about how we're fascinated in part because we won. Are there equivalents of novels like yours that have come out of Germany?
I don't think there are equivalents of novels like mine that have come out of Germany, but there have certainly been novels that have come out all over Europe that are effectively post-war novels. But they're not spy novels. They tend to be novels about the resistance, perhaps. That's as far as it goes. And they're not well known. If I mentioned Harry Mulisch, who wrote a wonderful novel, I think it's called The Assault, which is about the Dutch resistance. I had to go crazy until I could find things like that. There are some Polish novels. There are some novels that came out of Germany, Helmut Kirst and others. But they're not very familiar. But in a way, perhaps if you look at Günter Grass, now you're beginning to talk about a novelist who really understood the spiritual death that went on in Germany when he wrote the Tin Drum.
And you also had an experience where you lived in the Soviet Union in the 1980s, another place that certainly at least at that time where there wasn't the freedom to generate this sort of fiction. Is that sort of a responsibility that you feel that if to write about a place where writers in that place can't necessarily convey what they might want?
Well, I wasn't living in the Soviet Union, but I was traveling there for Esquire magazine. And one of the observations that hit me hard at the time was that, number one, Moscow was the darkest place I'd ever been in spiritual sense, or any sense you like. Certainly the Russians are great writers, or they always have been in the past. C, this combination ought to produce terrific Russian spy novels, but D, it didn't, because the Russians weren't allowed to write them. And so, perhaps with presumption, but for whatever reason, I thought, fine, I'll write them. And it was on that basis that I wrote the book called Night Soldiers. It was meant to be a Russian novel. It's actually meant, and it does a little bit read as though it was written as though it were in translation.
And did that experience of spending time in Moscow, of living in an autocratic place, also motivate you to want to write about that, what it feels like to be in that
environment? Oh, yeah. My experience was a naive American experience. And I don't think of myself as naive, but guess what? I knew that there was such a thing as a police state, but I had never experienced it firsthand. And to experience it firsthand, as I did in the Soviet Union in the 80s, that was very different, and that made me mad. And the way fiction generally gets written is writers are angry about something or other.
Back to our calls. And you can join us this hour if you'd like to talk with Alan first. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Alex is next in Milpitas. Alex, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I just want to ask Alan a question about some recent non-fictional work about the World War II and causes leading up to it, specifically Pat Buchanan's recent book, which main premise is that the causes of World War II was Churchill or British commitment to Poland's defense, which sort of precipitated Hitler's aggression against Britain and France. And that sort of challenges the conventional wisdom of causes of World War II. What would you say about that kind of approach?
Garbage. That's nonsense. I won't use the word I want to use because I'm on the public airwaves, but it begins with bull. No, that's ridiculous. Hitler knew perfectly well, Churchill knew perfectly well, everyone knew perfectly well that when Great Britain promised to defend Poland, that there was no way for them to get there. Look at the map. And then try to say that. No, that's nice, and you can get a book published that way, and you can get some on some talk shows, but basically that's ridiculous.
Alex, thanks for the call. Leif in Berkeley is next. Leif, go ahead.
I actually have two questions. Do you want them together or one at a time?
Well, let's go one at a time.
Okay. Well, the first one is, we certainly are kind of and have been for a few years now gripped by World War II mania, and I think part of that is the passing of the greatest generation. We see this historical resource slipping away, and we want to record it before it gets away. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about why no similar thing happened 20 years ago when the veterans of World War I were dying off.
I think the greatest generation was great because it had the greatest challenge. A lot depends in your life on when you're born and what war is going on when you turn 18. I hate to, it sounds kind of cold, but in fact, I think that's true. The First World War was, we sent an expeditionary force in 1917, and that tilted the battle, but it wasn't exactly a threat to America that was going on north of Paris. So it's not quite the same at all.
And it wasn't a war, as you say, that was such as great a war. It wasn't as pure a cause of good versus evil.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you can read Barbara Tuchman. You can read anybody you like. They're still not sure exactly how the First World War started.
And Leif, you had a follow-up.
Yeah, I did, and thank you for that. But the other thing, and perhaps you've covered this in your work, I have to say I'm not as familiar with your work as I will be soon. I always would like to have somebody try to get into the head of the average German who gets swept up in the thing and becomes a low-level Nazi but still is participates in the horrible atrocities. What about the guy that through curious means isn't really a horrible person but finds himself doing horrible things?
Toward the end of The Spies of Warsaw lies the very German you wish me to write about. It's right there. And a very, it turns out that he's a very important character.
And there are also, Leif, in the book, even the very first character, Herr Juhl, who is someone that Mercier uses to obtain information about what Germany might be up to. There's this great passage early on where he's involved with a woman who, it turns out, is also a secret agent, and he longs for this woman, and so he's willing to do anything, including giving away information about what's going on in Germany. And you describe him as someone who's like a fish that can see a succulent worm, and he knows there's a hook inside, but he doesn't care.
Yeah, right. I remember the passage.
And next to Beth in Palo Alto. Beth, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Alan, I've read almost all of your books, and I am female.
Wow.
I want to say that I think I enjoyed Night Soldiers more than any of them. I have an interest in Central Europe and Russia, and I would love it if you would go back there and write something else about that area. And that's an example of the what the former caller was talking about, of a person who kind of got caught up in the whole thing inadvertently and what happens to him. It's a marvelous book.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, that's Bulgarian in this case. And actually, I'm working on a new book, and it is has rather an Eastern European setting and may at least be an echo of Night Soldiers.
Beth, thanks for the call. Let's go to Ethan next in Davis this morning. Ethan, go ahead.
Good morning, Michael. I had actually more of an observation in general that I think is kind of an important one. It's been my observation as I've been engaged in many political discussions over the past few years that we have kind of a national obsession with World War II to the point we become rather short-sighted about other periods of history. You know, anything that's going on currently, people try to find some comparison to World War II, regardless of whether or not it's an accurate comparison. And, well, I don't want this to be taken as a criticism of spies in Warsaw. It's more just sort of an observation that, that because we as a nation came out as the dominant world power at the end of World War II, we continually return to World War II, I think, as a means of kind of pumping up the national ego.
Ethan, thanks. Interesting observation. Alan first?
Oh, I would find it somewhat hard to agree with that. I think one of the things that fascinates us about World War II is that it was very much good versus very much evil, and that when people stood up for the good side, they were legitimately heroes, sometimes dead heroes. But this was a real case of standing up for what you believed in and standing up and fighting evil, even if it was a lot bigger than you are. And I think that's one reason we continue to be fascinated by it, not because we won and did well thereafter.
I wonder if what Ethan, though, is also getting at is that perhaps there's a danger in sort of taking that experience from World War II and applying it everywhere where it may or may not be the case. Most recently, of course, that came up when President Bush spoke in Israel and talked about, you know, dealing with radicals, and we should have learned that lesson. That's what happened during World War II. So is that a concern of yours at all, that by focusing so much on World War II, we may sometimes apply lessons that no longer apply?
I don't think so. I think it remains a good metaphor. I think it remains a good metaphor, not because we won, but because we fought. There's a difference.
Hugh in Oakland is next. Hugh, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to, along the themes of people who warned about the coming of World War II, whether you ran across a French diplomat called François Poncet, who was the ambassador to Germany, to the Weimar Republic, and warned his superiors about what was coming, and subsequent to the Munich Agreement, when the Western Europeans let the Nazis have Czechoslovakia, he was reassigned as a result of his opposition to that agreement.
Hugh, thanks.
I've come across his name, Hugh, but he could just as well have been the hero of this novel as Jean-François Mercier, who in a funny way will stand in for not only Poncet, but others who warned and yelled and made the case as powerfully as they could that if you let this happen, you'll be sorry. Of course, the great instance is Churchill's line after the appeasement in Czechoslovakia, when he said, "You have had a choice between war and dishonor. You have chosen dishonor, and you shall have war."
Sounds like that Hugh might have come across another character that you should do some work with. Dave in Berkeley writes in, I agree that 20-somethings may not be as connected to World War II as older generations, but many of us still surprisingly are. Almost everyone I know had grandparents in the United States during the 1940s, can relate to the war because their family was directly affected or participated in the war. I think most people of my generation who has family with roots from that era are able to see the immense effects the war has had on America and the world.
I can only agree with that. I'm glad he phoned in and said that.
Your book is very literate, and the characters within them are also often so literate. Even Hitler. There's a passage late in the book that references Hitler's favorite Latin proverb. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And I think the proverb goes, it's in Latin. I can't reproduce it in Latin, but it goes something like, the world wishes to be deceived, therefore let it be deceived. Hitler was no fool, and he was not crazy. He was evil, and it's different. It's not the same thing at all. To say that he was crazy or paranoid schizophrenic or a madman, or they used to speak of him as in German a Teppichfresser, which means someone who gets so angry he actually lies down on the floor and chews on the carpet, that's really the wrong way to think about evil people like Hitler. He was a scheming, vicious, right-wing politician of Central Europe in his time. No more, no less.
And was he right about that proverb, that the world wants to be deceived?
Absolutely right about it.
Yeah. To Kevin in San Jose. Kevin, go ahead.
I have two questions, please. One is the French or the German attaché's plane went down in Belgium. I believe it was in February. The French high command acquired the exact plans for the invasion, and they refused to believe them. Why?
They chose to believe that it was disinformation. They chose to believe it was so good, it was so perfect when that event happened, that the general staff, which is were the people who made the decision, decided that it was meant to throw them off the scent of the true intentions of Germany.
And without giving everything away about the end of the book, there's that also plays in the enormous difficulty Mercier has in the novel of getting people to believe that, because they think, oh well, you know, the Germans are smart, they're just trying to throw us off.
Yes.
Question two, please. The French Air Force was rated roughly equal to the German Air Force in at least quantity, around 2,000 to 2,500 planes. However, they played absolutely no role in the defense of France. Why did the French Air Force refuse to fly?
This would have to be a very long answer. Some of the things I can tell you. First of all, the director of the Air Ministry was basically a Bolshevik, Pierre Cot. Number one. Number two, a lot of the military might of France was not committed because the French were afraid to commit it because they might lose them. When the Germans attacked, they attacked in a column that went 100 miles on the roads back into Germany. That was the dimension of the army that attacked France. And, of course, if they could have won the struggle of the fighter planes over that column, they could have torn it to pieces. But they did not fly. And when they did fly, it was too late. Also, some of the planes were destroyed on the ground. Also, some of the planes, although the numbers were good, weren't any good. There's one instance where a large contract to build aircraft went to a politically connected furniture maker. Stop. Alan. Good question. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for the call and the question, the detailed question. Mike in Baltimore joins us on the Sirius Satellite Network this morning. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hitler never opened up the second front with Russia. How do you think the war would have been different as far as prolonged or certain defeats or victories we might have had?
You might be speaking German.
Really?
Well, think about it. He, at the time that he conquered Europe, he had access to so many factories, to so much armament, to so much technical skill spread out from Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, really, you know, from all the way north and south. Probably he would have taken care of Scandinavia and Switzerland, solidified the whole thing, certainly beaten the English, and now there's the Atlantic Ocean starts to look like the English Channel, but I suppose what they would have done is come up through Mexico. And I do believe there probably were plans in the Wehrmacht to do exactly that. Very foolishly, Hitler attacked the Russians. Always a bad idea.
Mike, thanks for the call. I wanted to ask you one thing about some of the lovely little details that when I read it, I had to think, oh really? Did it really work like this? Because they do seem so stereotypical in a sense. And I'm referring to one scene in particular where Mercier is talking with the Russian couple that want his assistance. And so they're trying to work out how they might come to their aid. And the deal is that in order to signal that they're in trouble, they're supposed to go to the post office, open up a phone book, and underline something on page 27. I mean, it's so great. You read it and you think, oh, come on, did that really happen?
Of course it happened. Of course. I mean, I couldn't make that up. That's one of the signaling methods that was used at the time. And it's not a bad idea. You have a public phone book. You have a public phone booth. People are naturally in the booth. They're in there with a pencil in hand. They make a mark in a phone book. It's not going to mean anything to somebody except someone looking for it as a signal.
It seems like a scene from a motion picture. And so I should know, but I don't. Are any of your films, are any of your books in the works to be films?
No, not at this time.
Fascinating.
Fascinates me, too.
So. Yeah.
I know. all you producers out there.
Yeah, someone want an option? You can call in.
We still have, right? The option hour.
We just have a moment left. So let me ask you where you're going next. You indicated to one of our callers that you're returning to Central Europe, you think. What's in the works?
Well, I don't like talking about it too detailed a way, but I am interested again in Eastern Europe. I've been over in Western Europe for a time, and I think it might be time to move over into the regions of Bulgaria, Romania, Yugoslavia in there. I haven't worked there for a while, and so it looks to me now like vacation land. It won't turn out to be. It never does. It's always hard to do this. That's what I'm thinking about.
And will it be another what you call a 9-10 novel, one of these novels that focuses again on this time that precedes the great catastrophe?
No, because I've just done a 9-10 novel. So now it will be something that it's going to date just after. It's going to date not mid-war, but early war. The war is on. It's too late for 9-10. Now it's time to fight. And it has to do with the fighting in that area of Europe.
Will you ever get to the end of the war?
No. I don't honestly think so. I've thought about it, but I don't actually think it will ever happen.
Alan Furst has been our guest this hour again. The book is called The Spies of Warsaw. Alan Furst, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to have you on Forum. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. A reminder that if you want to learn more about the drought, our topic in our first hour of Forum this morning, it will be again the topic on This Week in Northern California at 7:30 tonight on KQED Channel 9. We'll take a look at that topic with Paul Rogers of the San Jose Mercury. That's coming up tonight on Channel 9. I'm Dave Iverson. Thanks for joining us on Forum this morning.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.